You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
Last month, in mid-November, Red Eye began a discussion with Derek O'Keefe about the rationales that imperial powers have been putting forward to justify their war-making. Specifically, such wars have centered in this century around the deception that imperial wars are being waged to protect those who, in reality, become the major victims of those wars. It is a doctrine the war makers, with their gift for linguistic duplicity, have called the responsibility to protect. This morning, Derek has agreed to return to Red Eye to continue that discussion. And if you missed part one, you can find it posted on the Red Eye website for November 20th. Derek O'Keefe, as many know, is a leading anti-war activist in Canada, a journalist, and an author. Welcome, Derek, and thanks again for coming back to the studio.
It's great to be back. There's so much to say about this and the duplicity of the war makers that we had to have another session, so happy to be back.
We ended our previous discussion exploring some of the facets of the attempt of Britain, France, the U.S., Canada, and other imperial countries to launch a major war on Syria. And this turned out to be the first major failure to launch a campaign built around the rationale of a responsibility to protect. So let's pick up at that point and address the question of why you think that this time the double talk failed.
Well, I think the double talk failed, and we touched a little bit on it last time, because of the strength of the anti-war sentiment that still exists in these countries that want to go to war. The governments want to go to war. The people are very reluctant, and more so because of the debacle in Iraq. This has been 10 years now, but they haven't been able to shake their Iraq syndrome. So I think when the prospect of the attack on Syria came up, people in the UK especially were very reticent to go along with the United States again. And as we mentioned last time, that vote in the UK Parliament really was a big turning point. And then we also touched a little bit on the geopolitical factors. In the Libya invasion, China and Russia essentially let the Western powers go along or go ahead. But they were upset with how far that intervention in Libya went and the regime change that happened. It was clear that Russia wasn't going to let this happen again through the UN Security Council in Syria. So you have a basic geopolitical factor there. Russia is still a significant power, and they put a lot of stock in their ally in Syria. The Syrian regime is an ally. Also, you have other factors and sort of the way that some war-making makes other war-making harder, or some saber-rattling makes other saber-rattling harder. So the whole threat of war against Iran, which has loomed for most of the past decade as well, and neoconservatives really pushing and backers of Israel really pushing for a military strike on Iran. This has changed the calculus of the Iranian regime as well. And I think because of that threat and the way it's been pushed on Iran, the Iranian government has also really thrown in with Assad and given major support, including some reports of, you know, elite troop deployment into Syria to support the government. And so I think because of the way those alliances shaped up, it was much harder to for Obama, who has to act as a realist because he's the one actually carrying out the invasion. So all the intellectuals and the people putting forward the responsibility to protect as a phrase, you know, that's one thing. But Obama had to think, well, if we do intervene, what are the other consequences? And I think, you know, that's partly what stayed their hand there.
There seemed to me, when we look back anyway, at starting with Iraq, that you had major powers like China, even like some European powers, certainly like Russia, being very hesitant about those wars. However, none of them, they never reached a point where any of them said clearly and directly, no, we don't support this. We oppose this. And the evolution over the decade seems to me to have marked a turning point from a definition, at least which the Americans took for granted, that they were still in a unipolar world. They were the king, and they called the shots. To a situation now where the other countries, the other foreign countries like China, like Russia, can say, no, we're now prepared to say the world has changed, and we're prepared to push our part in it. Do you think there is that kind of a, what I would say would be a dramatic change?
I would say it's been a dramatic change, and that was part of what Obama was supposed to come in and shore up, this lack of U.S. hegemony worldwide and credibility. But I think it's something that even the slickest president can't really clean up, this rejection of U.S. foreign policy and just rejection of the presumption to empire that we saw around Iraq, but even going back the Kosovo War and the whole post-Cold War period of the 90s, a very triumphant U.S. foreign policy. Other factors come into play as well. You might look at the rise of Brazil and generally the independence which the Latin American countries now proceed with. You know, Latin America has taken many steps to unite and to sort of minimize U.S. influence in that whole sphere. So Brazil, for example, and you know, a centrist regime or centrist government under Lula and Rousseff, but nevertheless very willing to disagree with the United States. They went and made deals with Turkey and Iran around energy and trade, and have often had Iranian leadership, you know, close ties with Iran politically and economically, regardless of what the U.S. says about it. So I think that's just one example, and that's a major, major power. You also have other regional powers with their own interests. Turkey is a U.S. ally, but still they'll operate independently. So there is a loss of hegemony, and you don't want to exaggerate it, because this is still the empire in the world. It's still the only country with military bases in every corner of the planet.
If we come back to the anti-war movement in this, the opposition to the war, popular opposition, which has been, particularly in Britain, mobilized consistently over the time and had an impact in this debate in Syria. So on the one hand, there's a gain that the war makers were stopped from proceeding with their plans. But the suffering of the people of Syria, the internal war inside Syria, continues. And I guess my question is, are people in the anti-war movement going to find a way to address and not simply ignore those kind of wars which cause terrible suffering?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we refer to the anti-war movement, but you and I both know as people who have participated actively in it over the decades, right now there's not a lot of movement. There's flashpoints where there's large demonstrations, but really it's networks of individuals who are doing their best. I mean, one thing in Canada, before coming to the crux of your question there, I mean, the one glaring absence in Canada is a political expression to the anti-war movement. We feel that on an issue like Syria or Afghanistan, we may have a clear majority of the public on side, based on polls and just based on speaking to people in the streets. But that's not reflected at all in the Canadian Parliament. So when the Syria debate came up, you had the British Labour Party and a big chunk of Cameron's own caucus, David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, voting against him on the war. But the NDP, the official opposition in Canada, all they could say was, we want to have a debate in our parliament. I looked all over the place and I couldn't find anywhere where the foreign affairs critic or the leader of the NDP had clearly said, no, we oppose an attack on Syria. We are going to do our best to stop this from happening. The Green Party, even the Green Party in Canada, sort of said, well, we'd prefer a UN resolution. But there is no strong expression from within the parliament of that anti-war sentiment. So I think that's a big shortcoming, and we have to that's an argument we haven't won with our political class, and just need to have different politicians is part of it. But getting back to the question, I do think the anti-war movement has a responsibility to look at the humanitarian crisis in a country like Syria, because you have to look at the whole region and the crisis of that whole region and the various factors. Just because the West didn't go ahead and bomb Syria doesn't mean there isn't foreign intervention that is contributing to this suffering. You have many of the Gulf states arming some of the more extremist rebel groups. As mentioned, you have Russia and Iran supporting the Assad government, which is committing atrocities against people. And millions have been made refugees. They estimate over 2 million outside the country, many more than that if you count the internally displaced. So the anti-war movement, we should be doing our best to contribute to relief efforts that are legitimate, but also pushing for the Canadian government to accept more refugees from this crisis situation. Most of these refugees are languishing in camps in Jordan, some in Lebanon, Iraq. Refugees who fled Iraq to Syria are now fleeing Syria back to Iraq, which itself is mired in violence. So I do think the anti-war movement has a responsibility to educate and do our best to mobilize awareness and support for humanitarian relief and just for a better understanding of the region as a whole, even when there's not a threat of a direct bombing. It's part of our responsibility.
So the question of broadening the scope of concern and awareness of these wars is a task still to be undertaken clearly by the anti-war movement here in Canada or elsewhere in the world.
Oh, absolutely. I just don't think we can understand what's happening without looking at the whole region and the whole world situation, if you will. But the region, for example, today, John Baird, the foreign minister of Canada, is in Bahrain. Yesterday, he had a reception with the crown prince of Khalifa in Bahrain. And he's had a number of meetings over the past year with the royalty, the monarchy, the regime there that has brutally suppressed the democracy movement in Bahrain. Canadian weapons are sold by the millions to the Saudi Arabia, millions of dollars of weapons every year to Saudi Arabia, which helped to suppress that democracy movement in Bahrain. Bahrain and all of those Gulf states, or most of those Gulf dictatorships, are aligned with various rebel factions in Syria. They're contributing to the conflict in Syria to varying degrees, and they're repressing their own populations and contributing to military buildup in the Middle East. But in the Canadian press and in the Canadian Parliament, no one's ever debating Bahrain, even though John Baird is wining and dining with the prince on a regular basis and selling weapons to the allies, the Gulf states. So that's just one example of why we need to broaden the frame, and the anti-war movement has to talk about that because no one else is.
So we start with a success in terms of what happened in Syria and what was stopped by popular opposition. And you're saying we go away with more work to do.
Much more work to do and so much to learn. We didn't even get into the situation of the Kurds who are fighting for autonomy in Syria and sort of caught between the two sides of that conflict. That's another area we could explore. But we might have to wait for part three on that.
Well,
not that I'm lobbying for that. I appreciate the time.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming in, Derek.
Thank you so much. Okay, bye.
Our guest has been Derek O'Keefe. He's an anti-war activist, journalist, and author. And if you want to get in touch with the expanding scope of activity of the BC anti-war movement, go to the website of stopwar.ca.